This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, April 24th, 2014. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Walton Arts Center presents singer, composer, and actor Lyle Lovett and his acoustic group May 6th at 7 p.m. This Texas-based musician fuses elements of country, swing, jazz, gospel, and blues in a convention-defying manner that breaks down barriers of music. Tickets and more information available at waltonartscenter.org or 443-5600.
KUAF is supported by Northwest Arkansas Media, publishers of Northwest Arkansas Times, Springdale and Rogers Morning News, Benton County Daily Record, and the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. These daily newspapers offer local, state, national, and international news, plus business and Razorback news. NWAOnline.com for more information.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, golf is a sport, but it is also a vehicle for life lessons about honesty and perseverance. We'll visit the green as First Tee of Northwest Arkansas spends an afternoon teaching golf and values to area youth.
And a look at the U.S. Senate race here in Arkansas, and Becca Martin Brown stops by. But first, Senator John Bozeman is still in the hospital today, recovering from a successful heart surgery earlier this week. The senator was diagnosed with an acute aortic dissection, or a tear in the largest artery in the body. Patrick Kramer, Senator Bozeman's spokesperson, says after the emergency surgery, doctors are pleased with the senator's progress.
He has been alert, awake, interacting with them, conversing with them. I'm sure he's in a lot of pain after that sort of procedure. So there's, you know, periods where there's rest time, but the family was in there yesterday pretty much the entire day, which they weren't able to do the day before.
So far, doctors haven't given a time frame for recovery. And Kramer says while several scheduled appearances in Arkansas by Senator Bozeman had to be canceled, it is mostly business as usual in the senator's Washington office.
The staff continues to work to help Arkansans with any issues they have with federal agencies and respond to legislative inquiries, and they've taken meetings up here in Washington with Arkansans that are in town, and then, of course, in the state, they're continuing to make the rounds and meet out there. So it's somewhat business as usual. We'll have a hopefully have a better timeline before the Senate goes back on Monday as to, you know, when the senator could be back in Washington, but as of right now, we just don't know. So fortunately, there aren't any votes this week, or we just unfortunately had to cancel a number of events that he had booked.
Kramer says that Senator Bozeman's family is appreciative of all the prayers, kind words, and well wishes that have come in from around the state and around the country, wishing a speedy recovery for the senator.
A pair of cases of rabies recently confirmed in the wild in Siloam Springs. Sue Weinstein, the state public health veterinarian and head of the rabies program at the Arkansas Department of Health, says both confirmed cases involved rabies found in skunks.
Some of the warning signs with a rabid skunk are that they're out during the day, which is not normal. Skunks are nocturnal animals, so they're out at night. And they're out during the day. They're generally acting very differently. They will come into the yard. They'll come try and get into a dog's pen. They're acting bizarre. And so it's fairly recognizable that these aren't acting in a normal fashion.
Weinstein says bats are also a common carrier of rabies. However, human cases of rabies are rare in Arkansas, the last such case occurring more than a decade ago. However, she says there's one thing animal owners can do to help ensure that the virus doesn't cross over into the general population.
The one thing we want to remind the public is to keep their animals vaccinated against rabies. It's the single most important thing they can do to create a barrier between rabies that's in the wild and people. It's certainly required to be vaccinated for all dogs and cats to be vaccinated, but people should consider vaccinating their cows, their horses, their sheep, their goats.
So far this year, the health department has confirmed 71 cases of rabies.
Members of the Fayetteville Firefighters Association will be hitting the streets tomorrow and Saturday to raise money for the Muscular Dystrophy Association. Jimmy Vineyard, president of the Fayetteville Firefighters Association, says that over the years, the fundraising event has been a success.
About 6 or 7 years ago, we changed to where we could do, we got a permit to be out on the streets there off Joyce and Mall Avenue for 2 days, a Friday and a Saturday, and then off of Shiloh and MLK on the south end for the same two-day period. We jumped from probably anywhere from $4,000 to $6,000 a year that we were raising to right around $30,000 a year. So it was a big jump, and that made a big improvement in how much money we could contribute to MDA.
Vineyard says collectively, Arkansas firefighters are aiming to raise around $250,000 this year for MDA through Fill the Boot fundraisers. And he says the amounts of money drivers drop into the boot when they stop varies widely.
We get everything from just small change from the cleaning out the ashtray to we've emptied the boots before and found $100 bills. You know, those are always pleasant surprises, but it's all walks. It's a person that rolls up in a beater car that's barely making it down the road that dumps money in, and it's people that come by in a Rolls Royce and drop money in. It's a very unique opportunity. I really appreciate the people in here in Fayetteville and how much they contribute, because our Build-A-Boot drive, and it's only 2 days, is the second largest contributor in the state.
The Fill the Boot campaign will take place between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. tomorrow and Saturday at the intersection of Mall Avenue and Joyce Boulevard, and at the intersection of Shiloh Drive and Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard.
The Northwest Arkansas Naturals added another tally to the win column yesterday. The Nats defeated the Springfield Cardinals 6-5. The four-game homestand concludes tonight at Arvest Ballpark. Happens to be KUAF night with the Naturals.
The 24th-ranked Razorback baseball team has now won three in a row, thanks in part to yesterday's win at Baum Stadium. Arkansas defeated Northwestern State 15-3. The win puts the Razorbacks at 27-16 on the season. The Razorbacks return to the field tomorrow to face Auburn in the second-to-last home series of the season.
Mostly clear tonight, lows around 42 in northwest Arkansas, 50 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, sunny, highs from 76 to 80. And for Friday night, partly cloudy, lows around 55.
This is Ozarks at Large. Last week, there was a packed house of 200 people at the Arkansas Governor's Mansion for a forum at the Political Animals of Central Arkansas's monthly meeting. Roby Brock from our content partner, Talk Business Arkansas, moderated the discussion, which included KATV's Janelle Lilly, John Brummett with the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and GOP strategist Bill Vickery. Here's how the panelists see the U.S. Senate race playing out, beginning with Mr. Vickery.
There's a couple of things with the Senate race, and I'm going to lump the governor's race in there, too, that, you know, we see Democrats now, and at least I've been hit with this last week, that, oh, my gosh, we've got these polls that show, you know, dead heat in the governor's race and Pryor's ahead in the Senate race, and this is not what we thought. And there's kind of this wave of rushing the field to tear down the goalposts before Easter, even. I think both of these campaigns are a little bit like a long baseball season. And I've never really believed in good polls or bad polls early on, because what really matters happens after Labor Day in terms of actual polling to understand where we are, because the ground and the terrain changes a great deal. Everyone in this room's worked in politics, you understand that. But you can make an argument in March and April and even May that the Kansas City Royals will get to the World Series. You can, you watch Kansas City television, they will tell you how the Royals are going to get. And pitching this year, we got a couple of young arms, and if the bats come around and we get to, and we got guys that can steal bases, and so all that, and it sounds credible. It is a credible argument. Can't be denied. You can't say that it can't happen. You can also make an argument that the New York Yankees will be in the World Series in October. The difference between the two arguments is not a lot has to happen for the Yankees to win, but a whole lot right has to happen for the Royals to get there. And I think that's the difference. Because of the president, because of his unpopularity, because of a number of issues, because of, just look at the setup of the ballot now. You look at the number of Republicans in the state house that are coming back as a lead pipe cinch. So everything has to go right for the Democrats to be there in the fall. Not a lot has to really happen for Republicans to continue to move forward.
And so are the Libertarian and Green Party candidates, are they the Cubs in your
analogy? Yes, that is the they're the Arizona Diamondbacks.
I got you.
For a lot of those guys.
Janelle, your take on this race.
We always say with Arkansas weather, if you don't like it, just wait until tomorrow. And I think this early on in the season, it's really hard to make a stance and say definitively. I mean, you've seen the poll numbers just like every one of us has, and they change all the time. There's a new one each week. And so I think it is April, and it's really hard to make those calls right now. And I wouldn't want to be the one to have to do it. So,
Brummett, wake up.
I was thinking it's a good thing for the Republicans, as Bill says, they don't have to do a lot between now and November to win. Let's take this current polling situation. Was on your show with Rex, and you asked about the Senate race, and that was, what, a month ago? And we both said smartly, advantage Cotton. Right now, to reinforce the point, that's not necessarily so. It looks from three consecutive or four consecutive polls that something has happened. Yes, it's all going to change. Yes, it's volatile, but this is what is happening. The anti-Obamacare flame is flickering just a little. It's been the fuel for the Republican insurgents. It can't last forever. Nothing lasts at full passion forever. It's still there. It's still strong. I think it may have stopped. The Democrats, thanks to Harry Reid's PAC spreading lies about Tom Cotton taking bribes from the insurance companies, they are managed to make the race about Tom Cotton also. It's not just about Obamacare, but who is this guy? You need to take a look at this guy. Right now, I think the Democrats are successfully taking advantage of the fact that there has been a sort of a ceiling on the anti-Obamacare discussion, and they're trying successfully to steer people's attention to Tom Cotton and just who he is and what he's all about. And it's going to be close to the end. They're going to spend, not they, the parties and the Koch brothers and the groups, they're going to spend millions from now until mid-October to keep everybody close, and then the undecided voters will decide at the very end. But right now, I think smartly and somewhat remarkably, Pryor and the Democrats have changed the conversation slightly from Obamacare to Cotton personally.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, challenging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at Bank Ozarks.
And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com. And the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. More at Arkansas State Chamber.
In just under 30 minutes, here on Ozarks at Large, a youth golf organization teaches not only the skill of the sport, but also valuable life lessons.
You know, you have a golf course, you have a par 3, a par 4, and a par 5. But we talk about how to set your own personal par, like whether or not you can get a 6 or a 7. And that's your own par that you set, not somebody else's set for you. So we talk about that, so not getting frustrated that you can't make it in a, you know, par 3 or par 4 or par 5.
A field trip to the fairway as First Tee focuses on the game and the values of golf. That's ahead on Ozarks at Large.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blue Show, which airs every Friday night at 9 o'clock. Join me this Friday. We've got some new acoustic Luther Dickinson. Also, Francine Reed, Cephas and Wiggins, The Insomniacs, Elvin Bishop, Roscoe Gordon, and more. Again, that's the Generic Blue Show every Friday night at 9 o'clock on KUAF. We'll see you then.
Take a major at an American college or university, any campus, any major, and you can trace the knowledge required for that degree back to one common discipline, English. The University of Arkansas English Department will take a day tomorrow to remind people of this. Dorothy Stevens, the chair of the University of Arkansas English Department, says tomorrow afternoon's Showcase Day will offer examples of how the study of literature and language connects all of us.
We go through our lives trying to reach out to other human beings. And it's never perfect, even, you know, if we're married, even if it's with our own children. And looking at how we form stories, how we tell our own story at any given moment is one thing. And then looking at how other people tell their stories to us, being able to put ourselves in their places, is what we do in this department, helping people understand that.
The words of Ezra Pound or the characters created by John Steinbeck can help us understand the human condition. And that appreciation ripples across the campus. Casey Kaiser, a clinical assistant professor in the Department of English, teaches a course for junior and senior pre-med students. Mostly chemistry and biology majors, Casey says the students in the class have plenty of coursework teaching the technical elements of medicine.
What my course does is it focuses more on the social aspects of medicine, how understanding the human condition through literature might help them to become better doctors, and how analyzing literature might help them to analyze a patient's story.
And her class reaches beyond the walls on the university campus.
My students shadow physicians at local health clinics and even in some of the community clinics. And then they also do medically relevant service work. So we have several partners in town where the students go out into the community. Seven Hills Homeless Shelter, we work with them, thinking about the ways in which poverty and food insecurity interact with health. We work with the Elizabeth Richardson Center, Lifestyles, and the VA. So my students are out there doing good work. And our goal is hopefully to produce more compassionate, community-responsive, culturally aware physicians.
The English department's outreach includes projects related to gender studies, the projects associated with the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies on campus, and the area-wide events connected to the One Book, One Community program that has spurred regional conversations about immigration, sustainability, and mental health. David Jolliffe, a professor of English and the Brown Chair of English Literature at the university, has recruited students working on their MFA degrees to help mentor students in Springdale through the Arkansas Studio Project.
An after-school literacy enrichment program for kids in the Springdale schools, generally of whom the parents of whom get home late and there's this three-hour block. I have consistently hired students in the MFA program to be the site coordinators. They're leading the efforts of a whole range of undergraduate students at the University of Arkansas who are serving as tutors, but they are mentors in helping these middle school and high school students learn to see the connection between the arts and reading and writing.
The English department also sends MFA students to schools in small Arkansas towns like Norfolk and Valonia to hold two-day poetry workshops as part of the Writers in Schools program. An annual anthology of the work created in the WITS program is published by the department. And this winter, we could all see evidence of the department's influence on HBO.
Ask you something. You're Christian, yeah?
No.
Well, what do you got the cross for in your apartment?
It's a form of meditation.
How's that?
I contemplate the moment in the garden, the idea of allowing your own crucifixion.
The series True Detective was conceived and written by Nick Pizzolatto, an alum of the creative writing program. Dorothy Stevens, the department's chair, says not every English degree leads to an HBO series or a published novel, but that degree can guide somebody almost anywhere.
Corporations you would think of as being connected to science and engineering come to us and ask to hire our graduates. And at first we thought they were, you know, making a mistake. We're English, not engineering. And they say, no, we want entry-level employees who understand that every problem has more than one solution, who can think outside the box. And English majors do that. And I have to say, one thing we get all the time is, what can I do with an English major? Parents are especially worried about that with their children. Recently, there have been several studies that indicate that actually English majors are doing quite well, thank you, as actually liberal arts majors in general, but because it teaches a way of thinking that is useful in so many fields.
The University of Arkansas English Department's Showcase Day is tomorrow afternoon from 3:30 until 5:30 inside the University House on the corner of Maple and Lindell on the UA campus. Included is a discussion of Shakespeare's As You Like It by Professor Joseph Candido. The play is currently being produced by the University of Arkansas Department of Drama. For more about the English Department's programs, you can go to their website, english.uark. It is Thursday, April 24th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And with us, Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Okay, today's theme,
because
we're doing that theme thing again,
is
Traditional Thursday.
Traditional Thursday, not Throwback Thursday.
No, Traditional Thursday, because what is more traditional than a community concert band?
I don't know.
If you think about, when you say community concert band to me, I immediately see the Music Man.
A gazebo and some bright red topped uniforms.
Yes.
Lemonade.
Lemonade, definitely.
Yes.
And horns, a lot of horns in Sousa.
Well, that's exactly what the Arkansas Winds Band is. And they will be playing all sorts of music on Saturday at the Art Center of the Ozarks, celebrating 25 years as a community concert band. Sousa actually formed his first professional band in 1892, and that's the definition of a community concert band. And the Winds Bands did some marching through the years, according to Michael Ferguson, who's conductor and music director of the Arkansas Winds, but they don't march. They gave up marching. But most of them did come out of band programs. Played in high school, played at the university, didn't want to stop playing. So Eldon Jansen, who you might remember, formed the Arkansas Winds in 1988 at the university, and it has gone on to be successful for 25 years.
That's great.
The show Saturday is at 7:30. It's the first, I think, of their celebrations of 25 years. Happens at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale, and it's $10 to get in.
Not bad. You know the John Philip Sousa connection to Northwest Arkansas?
What?
He helped open the Odd. I think then it was probably called the City Auditorium in Eureka Springs.
Really?
Yep.
How does he know these things?
He knows everything.
I don't know everything.
It's amazing.
I don't know. Anyway, Becca, thank you.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. An engineering researcher at the University of Arkansas has developed an endoscopic microscope capable of producing high-resolution subcellular images of tissue in real time. Tim Muldoon is an assistant professor of biomedical engineering at the U of A. Earlier this week, he stopped by Studio 123 to speak with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda about this fiber optic device, which is portable, reusable, and easily packaged with conventional endoscopes. During their conversation, Muldoon explained that this project, which started back when he was a graduate student, has been a collaborative effort with Dr. Rebecca Richards-Cortum from Rice University, as well as clinicians from MD Anderson and Mount.
I got this project first when it was only a concept. We had maybe like a very rough prototype that someone had been kind of tinkering around with, and then I took it over. And so we took it from a concept or an idea, tested it out in the lab on more complicated items. So we tested it out just looking on cells on a slide for a while. And then we built up to looking at little pieces of tissue, animal tissue or whatever we could get. And every time we had to, you know, iteratively improve the device until we could get it to a point where we could actually make it transportable and move it into a clinical setting. And so even by today's standards, it feels like that thing was very clunky the first time we brought it over to MD Anderson. It was in this big metal box. It was probably, you know, 2 feet wide and a foot tall or something like that. And I think it weighed about 15 pounds. It's kind of clunky, but it got the job done, and it was nice to actually be able to measure it on, use real patients in the clinic, in a clinical setting, sort of the way that we had envisioned it in the first place. So that was a big step to get there.
So what does the product look like now? Because it's not a prototype anymore. It's an actual microscope that,
right,
like, this is what I would sell to someone. This is something,
right,
that they,
right,
would use. So
it's not quite what I would say a commercializable product yet, but it's at the point where, yeah, it would look like something that maybe a doctor's office would use. Mm-hmm. So we have the entire thing enclosed in a small little box that's maybe the size of a piece of paper, maybe 2 inches tall, and then it runs via a single USB cable that plugs into a laptop. And so the whole thing is internally powered off of a rechargeable battery and that USB cord. And we have a fiber optic bundle that is about 3 feet long and a flexible bundle. So it's maybe, I think its outer diameter is maybe 2 millimeters or so. And that allows us to position by hand or by a mechanical positioner directly onto whatever type of tissue we're looking at.
And so does this work with a regular endoscope, or how does that work?
Right. So this project was also originally envisioned to work as sort of a piggyback technology onto a regular white light endoscope. And so these are things that people, I think, are very familiar with. So things like colonoscopes, colonoscopies, or EGD, which is upper endoscopy. Both of those systems are very flexible. Obviously, I think many people are probably familiar with what those things look like, but they incorporate a small channel inside that's a couple of millimeters in diameter. And what that is, it's called the biopsy channel. What clinicians can do is they put a little forceps through that little biopsy channel, and then that allows them to grab a region of tissue and bring it back for microscopic analysis later on. And so when you say you're receiving a biopsy, like, that's how they do it, at least in terms of endoscopic approaches. And so our thought was maybe we could introduce this through the biopsy port. And so that was what the Mount Sinai project was back when,
sure,
I was a graduate student. That is a little bit more complicated to start in a new environment. So we're looking at tissue after it's been removed from the body here in Arkansas, in Little Rock, actually. Our collaborators are at UAMS. Mm-hmm. In Little Rock down there. And so we're looking at this in a little bit more of a simplified strategy right now to try to examine tumor margins after a tumor has been removed. So the idea is that we can help surgeons to identify where the extent of the diseased tissue is sort of, you know, in real time, as opposed to having to wait to look at the cells under the microscope. We can kind of give them that information right there in real time.
What about this instrument allows you to do that in real time?
Right. So it provides an image of the actual cellular architecture. So almost the same as what a pathologist would look at under a microscope when they're looking at tissue, high magnification. This provides that sort of information sort of live. We can see that almost at near video rate. So they basically place this little probe about 1 millimeter in diameter, and it gives the clinician a live view of what the cells are looking like at that particular point.
So what do people do right now?
So right now, the standard of care at most tertiary care centers, so like a big medical center like UAMS or MD Anderson, things like that, we use what's called frozen section. And so what they do is they actually cut a piece of tissue that's around the tumor, cut a piece of that tissue out, and then it gets snap frozen in liquid nitrogen. A pathologist has to be present. What they do is they can slice that frozen tissue, stain it very rapidly, and then look at it under the microscope. That process takes 15, 20 minutes maybe to do, and so there's a little bit of a delay in the surgery while the surgeon is waiting to see how those margins turn out to make sure that they got all of the tumor. But also, it requires quite a bit of infrastructure, as you can imagine. You need to have either liquid nitrogen or some sort of way of snap freezing that tissue. And you also need to have someone who's very highly trained in doing that. I can't even do these frozen sections correctly. They're very challenging, I think,
yeah,
to get a good section that way. And so this device is sort of envisioned as a way of expanding that approach, to expand the way that we evaluate tumor resections. This obviously is it's a relatively inexpensive device. So the total cost of this device is maybe $2,000, $3,000, perhaps plus the laptop, depending on how high-end you want your laptop to be. And so I think that's something that we could hopefully in the future perhaps extend to smaller medical centers or more rural areas.
Because the price point is not astronomical.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And it should, in theory, require less highly trained personnel as well to operate.
How are you able to make something that's relatively inexpensive? Because I know some of the machinery at the hospital is hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so you've created this thing that's a couple thousand dollars.
Right. So our approach in my laboratory and overall is focused on optical means of interrogating tissue, imaging tissue or collecting spectra. Optical technologies, I think a lot of people can relate to this analogy, which is what I use in my classes sometimes, is that if you look at your cell phone has a little camera on it, and that camera is, I don't know, 10 megapixels now. Things in the optical imaging world, from the standpoint of sensors, like your cell phone camera, or light sources, LEDs, these things have become like ubiquitous in the last 10 years. And the technology that has driven that has driven it to a point such that the price point of all of those things has come down so low. And so we were able to build this system here at Arkansas. I think we built it, 2 years ago using pretty much the latest technology. And the camera that I purchased, I remember, it's a cube about 1 inch on a side. I think it's like maybe a 4 megapixel camera. So it doesn't have the pixel density maybe of a cell phone camera, but it has a pretty extensive resolution. That thing cost probably 1/10 of the camera that I used back when I was a graduate student, only in 2005, 2006. Mm-hmm. And so you can see how much things have changed just in those 7-8 years. And I think those technologies are continuing to be pushed. And again, I don't think it's a coincidence that we see these things in cell phones and cameras and laptops. And there's a lot of commercial push to get those things advanced. So I think optical technology, it's really come a long way, and it's helped us and helped my field of biomedical optics out a lot as a result of these consumer devices.
You mentioned the benefit of being able to have a picture in real time, so it sort of cuts down, I guess, on surgery time, which, less time less time under anesthesia and stuff like that. What are some of the other benefits of this device?
Well, I would say, so we discussed cost, we discussed the time that it would take, mm-hmm. perhaps, to analyze the tissue. I would say also optical technology brings something different to the playing field as well. So there's also been maybe another sort of revolution going on, maybe a little bit less visible, but in the world of nanotechnology and maybe to a broader extent, developing what's called molecular-specific imaging probes. And so we see a lot of things now that are available that weren't around, again, 10 years ago, where we have ways of putting optical tags, so things that are either fluorescent or things that are absorbing like an ink or a dye, very, very small molecules that we can target specifically to features or molecular features that are present in certain types of disease. And so in certain types of cancers, we know that certain types of cellular receptors or other proteins are present in that abnormal tissue that are not present in normal tissue. And so using our technology, you could potentially piggyback that on top of our current platform. And so the thought could be that we could use a very specific molecular specific dye and not only tell somebody that their tumor may extend up to a certain region, but also tell them what type of tumor is that, how may it respond to chemotherapy or radiation, what is the prognosis. So again, these are ideas that we haven't tested. These are ideas I'm very interested in pursuing in my laboratory group. But I think that there's a lot of work that could be done in that particular area.
With your partnership with UAMS in Little Rock, is there a specific area that you guys are working with as far as is there a specific disease or a specific part of the body that you're using your microscope on?
So again, right now we've focused on one particular disease. So we're looking at colorectal cancer. And specifically, like we were speaking about earlier, looking at whether we can use this device to not only map out the tumor margins, but to see if we can detect other regions that may not be apparent by eye that would be worrisome for development of cancer that the surgeon might want to know about. So if we see another nodule or another spot on the colon that looks, you know, maybe benign, maybe malignant, this is a way to sort of rapidly determine whether or not that region should be resected. And that right now is where we're at. That's sort of our active, you know, protocol. What I'd like to do is move forward and ask a little bit more of a clinical question. So I'm interested in inflammatory bowel disease and a lot of people who have something called ulcerative colitis, which is a type of inflammatory bowel disease, are at increased risk for developing colon cancer. And so what happens is they often undergo, unfortunately, a prophylactic colectomy, which means they remove their colon before they develop signs of cancer. And so my thought is, if we can get enough of those types of patients and perhaps screen them with this type of device, maybe this will help determine a more appropriate means to figure out whether somebody needs that resection or perhaps when they should get that resection. Again, that's going to take probably several years to acquire enough data to be able to do that. I'm not sure that this device is even capable of that yet, but that's something that I think would be a nice use for this type of work. More broadly, I'm trying to expand into other areas too. So we have other projects going on, and I have a few very enthusiastic collaborators at UAMS that are very interested in helping me find the right people to work with. I just put in a couple of proposals looking at lung cancer for other types of devices that we're building in our lab. So it's been a very exciting time. It's been very busy. We're coming up on the end of the semester, and so there's lots of things going on here. But it's nice to have some enthusiastic colleagues in pathology and surgery over there at UAMS that are interested in getting our research projects up and running.
So what's next for you, I guess, in the immediate future as far as this device is concerned?
Right. So this device, we have a grant from the NIH right now to pursue a modification to the device, basically. So what we're trying to do is expand the device from being able only to look at superficial cells and epithelium. So what we've done in the past is we place the device in contact with the tissue, and it provides nice images of the cells that are at the very surface. And we've shown that actually is fairly diagnostically helpful. It does correctly tell you whether or not there's cancer present. But it's not able to interrogate the deeper layers of tissue. And so one of the analogies that I think about is when we're looking at esophagus or colon or even skin, it's a stratified layer. So if you imagine like the Grand Canyon, you have like the layers on top and then you've got deeper layers underneath, right? Cancer in epithelial tissue usually arises at the basal layer and starts to work its way up. And that's because that basal layer is the layer of cells that's actively dividing, and then that's what replenishes the layers above. So the cells that are actively dividing are the ones that have a risk of becoming cancerous. And so one of the things I'm interested in is, can we detect that early dysplasia at those deeper layers? And right now, with the way that the system is configured, you know, we only see the later effects. We've only seen those cells as they've already pushed up to the top. So what this particular grant is, this project that we're doing, is looking at whether we can use a separate wavelength of light. So instead of looking at blue light, we're looking at red light. And instead of taking an actual image of cells, what we're looking at is we're trying to measure how the light scatters back into and out of the tissue. And our hope is that if we can measure how well that light scatters in and out, that'll tell us something about what's going on at those deeper layers. And so earlier we talked about the advancements in molecular dyes or molecular-specific contrast agent type projects. I think this is something that would go very well or work very well with this light scattering method. And so we're trying to develop both of those types of imaging modalities at the same time.
That was Tim Muldoon, Assistant Professor of Biomedical Engineering at the University of Arkansas, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda earlier this week. For more from this conversation, including how long it might be before you see this device in your doctor's office, you can listen to an audio extra at ozarksatlarge.com. And more information is available at comp.uark.edu/TildeTMuldoon.
Was Thoreau a climate scientist? I'm Ira Plato. Join me on Science Friday for a look at how the American philosopher is helping scientists think about global warming. Plus, the Science Friday Science Club meets again. Did you make your art machine? And the recipe for how the modern chicken and chili pepper came to be. All on Science Friday from PRI.
That's tomorrow afternoon from 1 to 3 p.m. on KUAF 91.3 FM.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums. Still to come, what it takes to get a hole in one, or two, or three, or four, and being okay with that.
But first, a couple of things to note for the upcoming weekend. Author Nora Gallagher presents Looking Vulnerability in the Eye tomorrow evening at St. Paul's Episcopal Church on East and Dixon Streets in Fayetteville. The opening reception begins at 6:30 with a lecture at 7. This event is free and open to the public. More information is available at stpaulsfay.org or by calling 442-7373.
Steely Dan is coming to Northwest Arkansas. They'll perform Thursday, July 24th at the Walmart Amp. Gates will open at 6 that night. Music will start at 7:30. Tickets go on sale tomorrow morning at 9. They range from $30 to $100, plus there might be some fees associated with your tickets. They may be purchased by calling 443-5600. You can also go to the website arkansasmusicpavilion.com.
Graduate NWA will host two events Sunday as part of Financial Aid April, a Northwest Arkansas effort to assist adults who have some college credit but no degree with returning to school to complete their education. The workshops will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. in Burns Hall on the Northwest Arkansas Community College campus in Bentonville, and from 2 to 4 in the Baldor Technology Center at the University of Arkansas Fort Smith. Volunteers at the workshops will help attendees fill out the free application for federal student aid and answer individual questions about how to pay for a college degree or technical certification. Additional information is available at www.graduatenwa.com.
When hiking in the backcountry, planning your hike is a necessity. What happens, though, when things don't go as planned? Would you know what to do to survive a short-term wilderness disaster? You can join Jerry Ward of Ozark Mountain Preparedness, LLC at Devil's Den, April 26th and 27th. That's this weekend. For a two-day, one-night outing, Jerry will be leading the group 3 miles into the Ozark National Forest to establish a base camp. Participants will then spend the weekend learning such basic skills as fire building, shelter construction, finding water and food, as well as the psychology behind surviving an unplanned situation in the backcountry. If you'd like to know more, you can visit ozarkmountainpreparedness.com. You can also call, and this is a different area code than we have, 870-350-6995.
A white bass fly fishing fly casting tournament and party benefiting Real Recovery has been scheduled for April 26th at Saddleback Brewery in Springdale. Real Recovery is a national nonprofit organization that conducts free fly fishing retreats for men recovering from all forms of cancer. Check-in is at 7 a.m. and return is scheduled for 3 p.m. There is a $20 entry fee. For more information, visit facebook.com/RealRecoveryArkansas.
This is Ozarks at Large. If you've ever taken a golf lesson, you're familiar with the advice to bend the knees, keep your head down, and follow through. Here's some more advice handed out during a golf lesson earlier this week.
What's an open-ended question again?
A question that does not have yes or no for an answer.
So it's something that requires...
Jason Kaufman, right? Golf coach, okay. Is teaching his young pupils how to introduce themselves to new people. He uses a three-letter mnemonic to help them recall the proper sequence, A-L-R, ask, listen, respond. The five steps include a firm handshake, making eye contact, asking the person's name, telling them yours, and asking an open-ended question to further the conversation. And yes, this is a golf lesson.
We'll assign them, practice those five steps with somebody at home, at school, or, you know, somebody that might come across in the grocery store, as long as it's not kind of awkward. Don't want them talking to strangers, but you do want them to be able to introduce themselves, and you want them. And for most kids, week one, this was pretty tough for them, you know. And then the last 2 weeks, we've made them do this with people outside the group, somebody they're not comfortable with. And so everybody's gotten better with it as the month has gone on.
What does this have to do with golf? At First Tee of Northwest Arkansas, the emphasis is more on life lessons and core values like honesty, respect, and perseverance than on correcting a slice or getting out of a sand trap. First Tee wants to use golf as an agent for learning and as a three-dimensional metaphor for better living. Learning how to carry a conversation with someone you just met can help later in college or in the professional world. Along with those nine core values taught is some golf. Mike Shea is the executive director of the First Tee of Northwest Arkansas, located in Lowell. He's been involved with golf course management for several years and with youth golf at each course. He says he was drawn to the First Tee concept soon after learning about it.
And without youth playing golf, there's not going to be golf. And so that's one facet that intrigues me. The other facet is at the First Tee, we're not just talking about golf, which no matter where the kids are from or how much money they come from or don't have or whatever, all of them can use the skills and the core values that golf teaches.
First Tee exists nationally, but each local chapter is independently operated. The facility in Lowell has been at the end of East Monroe Street for 3 years and has a driving range, a putting green, and more. Elizabeth Pringer, the director of outreach, can show off the entire 34 acres with a quick trip by golf cart.
And this is our first hole right here. We have three different tee boxes that you can hit from. So some people will come and do three laps, and they'll do the full front nine or what have you.
The First Tee of Northwest Arkansas operates on a combination of sponsorships from corporations and from public use and public donations. The three-hole course and driving range can be accessed by the public for relatively inexpensive fees. A bucket of balls for the driving range is $8, and a round on the three-hole course is just $6. Some days, the paying public mixes nicely with the students. Elizabeth says there are a few days when the course hosts a field day with local fourth graders.
They come out between 8:30 and 2, and they go through different stations around the course with our coaches and our volunteer coaches, and they really get a fun experience with golf, which otherwise they may not have that exposure to the game.
For those field days, everything is paid for, from the bus transportation to and from school to lunch and snacks. 13 schools, from Owl Creek in Fayetteville to Cooper Elementary in Bella Vista and several in between, are participating this spring. The classes, held once a week for a month, are $25 a month and held at the First Tee course. A course, by the way, specially designed for the location and the clientele. David Welchel co-designed the course with Executive Director Mike Shea and says it's not as demanding as most golf courses.
Case in point out here is on the right side of the first hole. I had a sand trap designed on the right side of the first hole, and Mike said, no, let's take that out of there. So maybe the kids don't get frustrated because the sand shot is one of the hardest shots in golf. So you try to keep it fun, try to keep it reachable for them. That's why we have all kinds of tees out there in different places. So they can get out there and hit it and find it and hit it again and finish the round. When they finish with a smile on their face, you've done something right.
Keeping frustration to a minimum, and if you've ever set a ball into water or putted seven times on the same green, you know golf can be frustrating. Keeping that frustration is a priority. Some of those core values taught through the program are confidence and perseverance. Again, Executive Director Mike Shea.
So we teach them how not to get frustrated. We teach them how to overcome problems on the golf course and in life. And so that's how that all works hand in hand.
And there is a mnemonic device for lessening frustration, the four R's: replay, relax, ready, and redo. One of the coaches at First Tee, Brian Thomas, says beyond that, they teach a skill known as personal pars.
You know, you have a golf course, you have a par three, a par four, and a par five. But we talk about how to set your own personal par, like whether or not you can get a six or a seven, and that's your own par that you set, not somebody else's set for you. So we talk about that, so not getting frustrated that you can't make it in a, you know, par three or par four or par five.
Brian began playing golf with his father when he was five, though he says there was nothing like First Tee to help him then. David Welchel, the co-designer of the course, began his relationship with the game later when he was a 20-year-old college student studying poultry science at the University of Arkansas. He had grown up in Huntsville before that town had a golf course.
And I do remember I shot 121, and I was hooked.
That was 18.
That was 18 holes. Yeah. Shot 61 the front nine and 60 the second
nine. You got better.
Yep, I improved. And I went that weekend. I couldn't afford new clubs. A struggling college student, like so many of us were, I found some in a garage sale and gave $40 for a set of golf clubs, a cart, and a bag. And I've been hooked since.
So he says he can relate to the young golfers from ages 7 to 17 enrolled in First Tee classes. And First Tee tries to make the introduction to golf inexpensive. Classes are $25 a month, clubs can be borrowed from the facility, and membership in the classes allows the young golfers access to area 9-hole Lindsay golf courses and some courses in Bella Vista for just a dollar a round. Elizabeth Pringer says if that's still too much money to spend for the child, there are scholarships available.
One Angel scholarship is a value of about $300. So we have a lot of our associate members sign up to be an associate member at that capacity on the $300 level to help fund that Angel scholarship program. And then also you can come in and invest $25, get discounted prices here at the clubhouse, and that also goes to the Angel scholarship as well.
And there's evidence the classes make a lasting difference.
I'm Hannah Brauberger.
While the under 12 class was learning about introductions and how to make a chip shot, Hannah was practicing at the driving range. She began with First Tee when she was 8 years old. That was 9 years ago. She says she still remembers the 9 core values being taught to her.
Yeah, because I teach them now. It's so weird, you know, going from actually learning them to teaching them.
So how many of you guys had a chance to practice a life skill last week? You remember what it is? Hopefully.
You can learn more about First Tee of Northwest Arkansas and the Tyson Foods First Tee Learning Center in Lowell at the website thefirsttnwar.org.
Hello, I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday night from 10 till midnight. On this Friday edition of Shades of Jazz, I'll feature music with Pat Martino, Joey DeFrancesco, vocalist Betty Carter, and Ileana Elias. We'll also hear some vintage Charles Lloyd and Dave Brubeck. All this and more on the Friday edition of Shades of Jazz.
Walton Arts Center presents Straighten Up and Fly Right tomorrow night beginning at 8. Jazz pianist Ramsey Lewis and guitarist John Pizzarelli unite to perform this tribute to Nat King Cole, which includes his hits and classic jazz. Tickets and information available at waltonartscenter.org or 443-5600.
Support for KUAF comes from Today's Bank, formerly First State Bank of Northwest Arkansas. Today's Bank welcomes new deposit accounts and is collecting food throughout April for Hunger Awareness Month. Located on North College and the new branch in Fiesta Square in Fayetteville, plus two locations in Huntsville. Today's Bank, member FDIC.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Rural, and Rudd.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
We will end today's show with a song from Big Piff, also known as Epiphany. He'll be at the Smoke and Barrel Tavern tomorrow evening for a performance and release of his new album, The Calm. That show begins at 9. This is his song, Lately.
So right about now, I'm feeling great. Like you said, story about around the way, girl. I'm feeling great. You know I've been around the way a little bit, too. I ain't never been to play tight. I dipped in a pimpin' and really worked out for me too well. So I'ma need y'all to just vibe with your folks for a second or three. Let me take y'all on this ride real quick. It's the same old same again. Passed you around the way when you was chilling with your main and them. I ain't really blaming them. You told me when we met you was a little bit involved with this brother.